effectively making it immortal. I was to learn this later. In these early days, I simply took the lot. Over the next few months, between hospital visits, my head was stuck into every reference book I could find, discovering, learning, trying to decipher fact from fiction. Hearsay and anecdotes were not enough to convince me to try something. I drove my oncologist and integrative doctors mad with questions, almost to the point of mental combustion. I rifled through endless scientific papers. There had to be real, hard scientific evidence. Although there was often no real science behind the stories, anecdotes of survival against the odds were also therapy. I bought as many of these as I could, looking for any kind of recurring pattern that linked them. I was desperate to find clues that it was even possible. Every unusual disappearance of the disease was described as a spontaneous remission by the medics, a deprecating term when you realize the Herculean effort involved to achieve it. Each appeared to be linked with a radical change in diet. Cutting out sugar was a common theme. While these worked for some cancer patients, few anti-cancer diets I investigated seemed to go far enough in lowering glucose. The term ketogenic diet, a more extreme low-glycemic diet, had not even been coined in those days. Bizarrely, some diets still included honey and pizza, bread and other starchy foods. Foods I would class as high glycemic, they released a lot of glucose. As a result, they still raised insulin levels. Surely these would be disastrous for cancer patients. This was the diet espoused by Professor Jane Plant in her best-selling book, Your Life in Their Hands. Her focus had been on lowering IGF-1 by cutting down on meat and dairy. Professor Plant's diet suggested a swap from sugar to honey, which seemed illogical to me. How would that starve the cancer of glucose? Sugar is sugar, in all its guises, honey included. My spot of bother chart thus far only had treatments I'd heard about while researching for my mother. It was 1999, and information was still hard to come by. Now Facebook is awash with cures and alternative doctors ready to share the latest trend. In fact, it has now become too confusing to track. Back then, with a bit of digging online, I found the Gerson diet, macrobiotics, proteolytic enzymes, bitter almonds, and intravenous vitamin C. I hadn't been radical enough with my diet, but I was not convinced that Gerson took the whole low-sugar approach far enough either. Potatoes were allowed for a start. They were definitely on my banned list. Not only would they potentially elevate insulin and glucose levels, they were part of the nightshade family of plants and could cause gut reactions. While potatoes were alkaline foods and neutralized acid foods, they can also cause inflammation, something I knew to be a major factor in my cancer. Today you can buy kits to test yourself for inflammatory reactions to food with just a few drops of blood. Interestingly, the Gerson approach seemed to work best for melanoma patients. What was so different about this cancer? Was it metabolically different to other cancers, less driven by glucose? It turns out it is more driven by fat and glutamine, so ketogenic diets are a disaster for melanoma patients. Cancer diet books in 1999 focused mainly on either macrobiotics or Gerson. I thought both had their merits and pitfalls, but the low glycemic approach of macrobiotics, with its emphasis on whole high fiber complex carbohydrates, seemed to make more sense to me. The seaweed element, disgusting as it sounded, was probably useful. I'd wondered if I might have an underactive thyroid, and I wanted to boost my iodine levels naturally. Seaweed was said to do just that. I instinctively felt my focus should be on starving the cancer, but there was very little information about keeping blood glucose low. I could find no information on this specific to cancer. A diabetic friend of mine had discussed low glycemic diets with me when I treated him with physiotherapy. I had saved him from major back surgery. At the time, I'd been researching for my mum, and as a thank you, he gave me a book by a Frenchman called Michel Montignac. Michel Montignac was the first to actively promote a low-glycemic diet to the public. It was called Eat Yourself Slim. Perhaps my friend was really just telling me I was a fatty. His diet method became very popular in Europe in the 1990s. It was designed for weight loss, to avoid cardiovascular disease and diabetes, but not for cancer. Montignac had been a seriously chubby young man and had ended up working for the pharmaceutical industry. He realized that it was the high glycemic foods that caused weight gain and health problems. He was the first to expose the hoax of calorie counting. The quality and choice of what you ate was far more important than counting the energy input versus the energy output. Je mange, donc je maigris. I eat but lose weight was a very popular book. It certainly seemed a good idea to adopt the low glycemic principles. I discovered that eating fat on its own was apparently not a problem for insulin and glucose levels. It wasn't the demon it was made out to be for cardiovascular health. I memorized the glycemic value of different foods, the amount of insulin released by the pancreas to deal with the sudden spike of glucose released after a meal, and how food preparation and the method of cooking could make big differences to the glycemic index. Reducing blood sugar was my primary focus, but I worried about the type of fat I ate. High-fat diets had been linked to cancer too. As if to prove the point, I discovered Michel Montignac had died at the young age of 63 of prostate cancer. His heart and insulin levels perfect. Prostate cancer, I was to learn, was driven by fat and protein. Low glycemic diets made perfect sense to reduce blood glucose. I still lacked any further specific information on how precisely to starve my cancer of the nutrients it craved. But lowering glucose and saturated fat seemed to be critical. I was concerned that high-fat diets might be too taxing on my liver and gallbladder. Je mange donc je maigris was a forerunner to the more famous Atkins diet, and the recent Eat Fat, Get Thin by Dr. Mark Hyman, who has gone further into healthier fats. From eggs, nuts, avocados, olive oil, and coconut oil. Both books are focused on losing weight. They weren't written for cancer. Cancer nutrition needs specialist attention beyond weight loss and heart disease. The principles of the diet, though, were the real message. In particular, they taught me which foods raised glucose and insulin, high glycemic foods, how to best combine foods, how to best prepare foods, and that slow cooking was preferable to both speedy cooking and overcooking. Simple carbohydrates, refined grains, sugars, some fruits, triggered spikes in glucose and insulin levels. The liver then converted excess carbs and fat to more fat. This was the problem. Slower release carbohydrates, in contrast, did not lead to an insulin or glucose spike. Fat without sugar just got shuttled out of the body through the reverse cholesterol transport system, I would later learn. But I still wasn't sure what to do about fat. Too many of the omega-6 oils, sunflower, canola, routinely used for cooking, encourage angiogenesis. The growth of new blood vessels around a tumor to provide it with nutrients. These were definitely on the banned list. Perhaps it was a lack of omega-3 fats in our diets, found in fish. These damped down inflammation and helped put the brakes on cancer. Did some saturated fats help drive cancer then? Coconut oil was saturated. Could it be trusted? It's become the oil du jour nowadays, and an integral part of a ketogenic diet. Coconut oil may in part be good, the medium-chain triglycerides, MCT, part, which makes up 13 to 15% of coconut oil, but the rest might be less beneficial. I decided to stick to olive oil and small amounts of butter to cook with. grass-fed butter contains an important ingredient called CLA, conjugated linoleic acid, which has been linked to lower rates of cancer. I also took CLA as a supplement. Sea buckthorn oil may be a better choice. Researching cancer treatments was as clear as mud, particularly if there were no proper trials conducted or the data had been manipulated. I was learning that gut health was crucially important for the immune system, but I was more than dubious of those coffee enemas encouraged by the Gearson protocol. I worried that while they allegedly cleansed the colon, probably a good thing, if the enemas were done to excess and the Gearson diet seemed to suggest 3 times a day, then you might be losing valuable nutrients or electrolytes, like magnesium. According to the Gearson diet, the enemas could encourage more glutathione to be released by the liver, which I soon learned might actually help cancer progress. Might this be a potential disaster? Like most patients I've met, I made the common mistake of thinking glutathione would be beneficial for cancer. If I were to try enemas, it would be straightforward colonics after my chemotherapy and using water only. Proteolytic enzymes are a large part of Gearson therapy and would do me no harm, as far as I could tell. They'd at least help me absorb food better. But the suggestion was to take these between meals, allegedly to dissolve the outer fibrin protection of cancer. I was not sure this was the reason they worked. Cancer had been often linked to parasites. Perhaps they helped get rid of parasites in the gut by dissolving their protein membranes. Not that I knew I had any at this stage. Bitter almonds or Laetril seemed interesting. Could they help to selectively kill my cancer? Every time I found something that looked useful, there was something conflicting in another book or website. I bought many books, subscribed to integrative cancer and health journals, and spent weeks in the library sipping green tea, popping my ever-expanding quantities of supplements, and knocking back, as quickly as possible, my revolting primordial soup. I scoured medical journals, PubMed, and Medline. I read many self-help books and huge tomes on alternative cancer therapies, desperately looking for clues. Dr. Ralph Moss and Burton Goldberg were fascinating and informative on complementary treatments. How many of these might help me? Iscador, a mistletoe treatment, seemed interesting. Coley's toxins? Essiac tea? No stone unturned. But what had the best evidence? Intravenous vitamin C at high doses seemed to have good evidence for increasing oxygen around a tumor. That would help kill it. I wondered what might happen if I combined chemotherapy and intravenous vitamin C. Would it boost its effects and help maintain my immune system? I was tempted to have a go at alternating the two, but in the end, fear of the unknown got the better of me. I would have it as soon as I finished chemo, and perhaps the supplements would be enough to maintain my immune system. After visiting Dr. Etienne Caliboe, a very knowledgeable, integrative doctor, my spot of bother chart was filled up nicely. I collated all the information and went with my gut, as well as with my research on what I felt would work best for me. Dr. Caliboe wanted to do a full examination, send off a stool sample for a thorough analysis of my gut bacteria, and take a blood specimen to evaluate my vitamin, amino acid, and fatty acid status. But as soon as he learnt I was to have chemotherapy, he decided there was little point until I'd finished. These blood and stool tests went on my to-do list. I would wait for a month post-chemo to allow my poor body to settle. Dr. Caliboe also guessed I was low on folate, as I had been given methotrexate chemotherapy when I was first diagnosed. Folate is necessary for the de novo, from new, formation of a nucleoside, a building block of DNA, specifically thiamine. Methotrexate, in effect, starved the cancer of this vital B vitamin needed to create a new daughter cell DNA. Interesting. Was it safe to add folate to my regime again? Dr. Caliboo said if I was not taking methotrexate or 5-FU, then I should supplement